Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, continuing with our in-depth, ongoing investigative reporting series on vaccines, a second opinion. Before I get into the specifics of today's topic, which will focus almost exclusively upon, are vaccines safe? We've been led to believe they are, and therefore shouldn't be questioning public health policy. I would like to read a few of the articles that have not made it into the mainstream media's attention in the United States, but nonetheless are important for us to be aware that there is a growing groundswell of interest in vaccines, in particular from parents who believe that the childhood autism they're seeing and other conditions are directly related to the vaccine, primarily because the child was completely normal, had no adverse health effects whatsoever until immediately after the vaccines, and then regressed into this state of autism or some other form of behavioral abnormality. The public health official says there's no connection. Well, they disagree. What's important now is the first of a series of lawsuits are challenging this entire presumption of innocence on the part of the vaccine manufacturers. We may be looking at something not too dissimilar than the tobacco litigation or the current litigation against Ritalin or some of the other class action lawsuits for environmentally induced damage. But this is not coming from the United States. This is coming from England. This is from Celia Hall, medical editor of the Electronic Telegraph. She says, a mother who claims that five of her children developed autism only after having their measles, mumps, and rubella vaccinations is taking legal action on behalf of three of them. Mary Robertson, 38, of Hell, Cornwall, said only her oldest child did not have autism. Solicitors, which are lawyers there, had accepted as clients three of the children who have been officially registered as autistic. Solicitors for the Robinson family said that 850 British families had now been granted legal aid. A spokesman for Alexander Harris, joint lead solicitors in the MMR, Measles, Mumps, Rubella action against the drug companies, Merck and Company, Smith Kline, Beecham, and French Laboratories, said they had about 750 clients. We get about 10 approaches from families a month. Not all are accepted as clients. Children have to meet our own criteria for inclusion. Mrs. Robinson said she was not told about possible risks from the injections. She claimed that she would never have continued having her children immunized. They were, to all intents and purposes, completely normal children. Then they had the MMR vaccines. Everything changed. This comes from James LaFano from today's Electronic Telegraph. And it's a statement that says, when friends ask should children be immunized, my answer is no. I'll quote verbatim. I take a dim view of health scares for obvious enough reason that the hundreds I have encountered in my 15 years at the Sunday Telegraph have proved to be without foundation. Their unifying feature, whether it has been the imminent heterosexual AIDS epidemic, passive smoking, declining sperm counts, electromagnetic fields, and so on, ad nauseum, is they are both biologically implausible and intellectually incoherent. The exception, clearly an important one, is the alleged link between the MMR vaccine and childhood autism, highlighted yet again last week by the disclosure that the safety studies conducted prior to the vaccine's introduction lasted a mere 4 weeks. By definition, there was thus failure to detect adverse symptoms appearing after this time, which renders quite meaningless the official protestations that the vaccine has been proven safe. The immediate response to Dr. Wakefield's report of 12 children whose autism and bowel symptoms appeared to follow soon after their MMR immunization was that it was a coincidence. The MMR is usually given about 18 months of age, which is also the time it takes for parents realizing that there may be something wrong with their child's development to attain a specialist opinion and be told the diagnosis. Further coincidences, explanations appear to be vindicated by a survey conducted by Professor Brent Taylor of London's Royal Free Hospital. On investigating the circumstances surrounding the diagnosis of autism in about 500 children in North London, he found that the timing was the same irrespective of whether a child had been immunized or not. So our parents might quite naturally have suspected that with their child's autism and MMR immunizations coming so close together, they might be related. But they were wrong. End of healthcare scare. Or is it? Mostly children with autism are born with a condition, although it may take up to 18 months before it is diagnosed. But the characteristic feature of Dr. Wakefield's cases is that the children's initial development was entirely normal, and they achieved their milestones just as predicted. Then suddenly and catastrophically they lost their skills and that they had already acquired, and they became withdrawn, intellectually uncurious, and socially disconnected. This type of devastating regressive autism, where the wiring of the normal brain seems to go haywire, has been recognized in the past as a rare variant, accounting for at most 5% of all cases. In Professor Taylor's survey, they constitute 25%, and an even more recent one from South London, they constitute 50%. Simultaneously, while the proportion of cases of regressive autism has escalated, so has the total number, a fourfold increase, both here and in the United States in the past two decades, when the MMR vaccine has been widely used. Professor Taylor's survey completely fails to address either of these phenomena, which self-evidently are highly relevant to the postulated link with the MMR vaccine. Hence his conclusion that it is all just coincidence is, like the four-week safety studies, quite meaningless. To put it another way, the rise both in the frequency and type of autism is precisely what would be expected were the link between MMR vaccine and autism, as originally identified by Dr. Wakefield, and attested to by so many parents, genuine. So now, when I'm asked by friends whether they should have their children immunized, my answer is no. Unquote. And again, that's by one of England's most eminent and respected health writers, and where I would certainly take issue to his original statements that he has found no basis for questioning electromagnetic pulses from cellular phones by definition, and some of the other health scares. He's as orthodox as they get. He at least now has looked into the MMR and autism, and he's saying no. We have had no corresponding challenge to the orthodox view by any of the mainstream journalists, print, broadcast, or television in the United States, at least not thus far. Hopefully, over time, with enormous public challenge to this, and it will be a challenge that will be fought, mind you, be very clear on this. There will be tens of millions of dollars spent, it's estimated a minimum $3 million last year, of hiring PR firms that will plant stories through prestigious highly respected social journals, public health journals, and mass media publications, trying to scare you into believing that you're an irresponsible parent risking your child's life if you don't vaccinate, and that anyone challenging it is doing so from a completely unscientifically supported position and is irresponsible. The average person could believe that if they didn't have any points to counter it. I would ask you, for anyone who questions the safety and efficacy of vaccines, please refer them to my website, GaryNall.com, Vaccine Investigation, because there is no emotion, there's no hysteria, there's no opinion. Everything is neutral except the facts. And the facts clearly, unequivocally, absolutely show that there is not a single vaccine in the world anywhere that can be proven safe or effective for all the people being used. None. Zero. No human being on earth can challenge my statement with facts. Now, you can still choose to vaccinate. That you're right. I do not tell people whether they should or should not. But for any journalist who assumes that the only people who are making statements to question the validity of vaccine are irresponsible people without scientific background, remind them of those of us who have high scientific background with honors and have never had to change a sentence because we do our homework. They have not. Ask them, who is irresponsible? The scientists and pediatricians who accept as a given that these vaccines can be predicted of who they will protect and that there's no real safety hazard. And I believe that over the next 2 to 3 years, and I think it will take that long, you will see between 20 to 100 articles appearing that will try to convince you beyond a shadow of a doubt. At some point, they will probably get the Surgeon General, the President or President's Advisory Committee, and these will all be people who are coming forward who have been coached by the vaccine manufacturers. The scientists will be associated with the vaccine manufacturers, or some connection will be that will be out of the public light, as they have in the past with DDT, trying to show you it was safe. Remember when the professor at the University of California took a teaspoon of DDT and ate it, testing that that's how safe it was? Well, just imagine the consequences if we hadn't banned DDT. And he is a leading quackbuster. But he was the man that this community trusted. Misplaced trust. Another article. This comes from Lorraine Frazier, medical correspondent from the Telegraph, which again is a major English publication. MMR, which stands for measles, mumps, rubella, doctor links 170 cases of autism to vaccine. I'll quote verbatim. The consultant who first raised concerns about MMR vaccination has disclosed to the Telegraph that he has identified nearly 170 cases of a new syndrome of autism and bowel disease in children who have had the triple dose injection. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, a consultant gastroenterologist at the Royal Free Hospital in London, said that in the majority of cases, parents documented evidence that their child's physical and mental decline had followed the vaccination. Professor Wakefield said, "Last week in our clinic, we saw 9 or 10 new children with exactly the same story, referred by jabbing pediatricians from around the country, who said, this child developed normally, had a reaction to MMR, and is now autistic." In his first public comments since the row erupted in 1998, when he reported on 12 cases, Professor Wakefield said that he remained seriously concerned by the safety of the vaccine, despite assurances from the Department of Health. He said, "The department says that the safety of the MMR has been proven. The argument is untenable. It cannot be substantiated by the science. That is not only my opinion, but increasingly the view of healthcare professionals and the public." He said, "Tests have revealed time and time again that we are dealing with a new phenomena. The Department of Health's contention that MMR has been proven to be safe by study after study after study just doesn't hold up. Frankly, it is not an honest appraisal of the science, and it regulates the science issues to the bottom of the barrel in favor of winning a propaganda war." The doctor, who was fiercely attacked by health officials for voicing his doubts 3 years ago, said in an exclusive interview that he felt driven to break his silence because of the accumulating evidence. His remarks will infuriate the government, sharpen the dilemma of parents over whether to have their children inoculated with MMR. It emerged last month that a rising number of doctors and nurses were worried about giving second doses of the vaccine, and pressure is growing for its separation into three component vaccinations spread over 3 years. In his 1998 article in the British medical journal The Lancet, Professor Wakefield reported finding a devastating combination of bowel diseases and autism in 12 children. His revelation that that figure had reached almost 170 cases, will shock parents and doctors and add pressure on the government to justify his vaccination policy. This month, Dr. David Salisbury, the head of the government's immunization program, insisted that MMR was safe. The vaccine, which contains live measles, live mumps, and live rubella virus, has been given to millions of children in the UK since its introduction in 1988. But the take-up rate has fallen sharply since Dr. Wakefield made his original claims. 10 days ago, health chiefs warned parents that Britain could face a measles outbreak unless more of their children were vaccinated with MMR. Professor Wakefield said, however, that if an outbreak were to erupt, it would be the fault of the health department, which had failed to address the safety issues. The doctor and his colleagues are testing the hypothesis that the measles virus from the vaccine can lodge in the gut of susceptible children, damaging the bowel and causing autism, and that the addition of mumps virus makes that more likely, unquote. I might mention that virtually every major public health official in the United States, without exception, every member of the FDA, which would clearly be expected, the CDC, all agree, marching in complete goose step together, turning to the left and raising their arm in some false allegiance to the pharmaceutical cartel. Whatever you say, we certainly will support, because we don't want to look like we've made a bad mistake once again. Once that thalidomide happened, everything post-thalidomide is based upon denial, denial, denial. And the question is, will we ever have a public health official, will we ever have a scientific bureaucrat who has the courage to come forward when they're faced with irrefutable evidence and to challenge the existing prevailing views? We haven't yet. Hopefully, at some point, we may find that person. But like they did with Professor Wakefield, who has a distinguished reputation, will he then be jumped upon by everyone else who's afraid to acknowledge that they had made public policy? What will it do? Will all the pediatricians be sued? Will the FDA be sued? Will it be one of the major scandals of our time that we've caused an entire generation to suffer needlessly? Will parents simply say, well, it's okay, it was an innocent error, and walk on? Will the government create indemnification programs so no one will have to pay any damages and everybody will say, well, it's not our fault, we were just following policy? And have we ever heard that before, where people committed crimes unintentionally but with ignorance of the facts because they were just following orders? We have militarized the way that public health officials do business in the United States. Something has to change at some point. And maybe it's from the consumers demanding that this be investigated with objective individuals. Remember, anytime, any state agency, any government agency puts together a blue ribbon panel, the fix is in. Kiss truth goodbye. Always. Never one single exception in my entire career. I've never seen an objective group from the Warren Commission on. And yet the media has consistently believed without challenge everything anyone who's in a position of authority within any agency has told it, and looked at anyone who was challenging it as Peck's bad boy. So it's not an easy position that it puts the public in. Who do you believe? I say, believe no one. Look for the facts. Examine them, challenge them, question them, and then make your choices based upon facts, not personality, not posturing for authoritative, undisputable policy-making position, just facts. This comes from Lorraine Frazier, an article entitled "Shame on Officials Who Say MMR Is Safe." When Andrew Wakefield first told the Department of Health 3 years ago of his fears about the combined measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and described to ministers the terribly damaging effects to children that he had examined, he assumed that he would be taken seriously. Since then, however, he has been pilloried for voicing his concerns, and the department's only response to his findings has been to undermine or ignore them. In fact, despite being aware of worrying new evidence, it has continued unwaveringly to reassure the public of the safety of the combined vaccine, which a growing number of doctors fear may have triggered serious side effects in thousands of previously healthy children. After a period of public silence, Dr. Wakefield, an expert on inflammatory bowel disease, has decided to risk the wrath of the department again because he believes he has now amassed enough evidence to seriously question the government's stance. And then goes on to talk about this one person's concern about how dangerous it is for the person to come forward no matter what evidence they have. And it's not just what he has found. There's other researchers who are also finding it. In fact, one of the ones that she cites here is a scientific paper that was published from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden reveals that the longest period of follow-up in any published safety study for these vaccines was just 4 weeks. Well, the question is, what happens if you have an adverse effect after 4 weeks? It's not considered an adverse effect of the vaccine. That's absurd. Of course it's absurd. So now they're starting to get with the lawsuits, with some editorials, with a few journalists having the courage to actually challenge the status quo, where our journalists are doing everything they can. It's like, okay, we've got a DDT. Journalists jump in there to protect the status quo. We have a thalidomide. Protect the status quo. We have silicone breast implants. Let's protect it. We have Three Mile Island. Let's not let anyone think anyone died, even though 50,000 baby died within 3 years after that, 3 months after that. Let's protect it, deny it, avoid it. I could give you 200 major public health instances where the media was a part of the problem, not the solution. And only when it became impossible to protect those in positions were they then able to turn around and show some light on the problem. But they didn't uncover the problem. It's one type of journalism that uncovers the truth, irrespective of the political consequences. And it's another that reports grudgingly the truth, but not because it wanted to. Think of all the times that we have been assured over and over again from experts that the truth was on their side. How about Gulf War Syndrome? They're still saying that, and that's 11 years. And every year, another 50,000 of the 700,000 who served get sick. At what point will they finally be forced? Well, piece by piece, we're forcing that. Piece by piece, they denied that there was ever an experimental vaccine used. Then we found, one courageous person found, a professor that I interviewed, found that there was squalene. They denied it. Then we got the batch numbers from a nurse that had saved one, contacted the manufacturer. Yes, indeed, 70,000 vials of that had been provided. But did that go through the FDA? No. Is that against the law? Yes. Did they violate all federal safety standards? Yes. Was anyone held accountable? No. Was ever anyone punished for that? No. Did they tell us which 70,000 GIs were given an experimental squalene vaccine, which is primarily used in AIDS research? Does that mean that they were using experimental vaccines on GIs for AIDS research without telling them? Yes. Do they have a history of using experimental vaccines or mind-altering drugs on service personnel without their knowledge or consent? Yes. How do we know that they've done this? Well, 4 years ago, the Pentagon turned over 1,991 studies just on low-level radiation that they had given to people without their knowledge or consent. And that was just one type of study. So all the time they do this. But this time there was just a piece of evidence. And that piece of evidence went through the process. Now they have finally admitted that when they started doing the tests, they found the antibodies, the squalene, in the blood. What happened to the 70,000 GIs that got this? Oh, all their medical records disappeared. I see. Would that be obstruction of justice? Of course, if you or I did it, it would be obstruction of justice, a felony. What if the government does it? Business as usual. So we have two standards. One for anyone who works for the government, in the agencies themselves, and one for everyone else. That's correct. Is that democratic? Who said we had a democracy? Only a fool would think that. So what we have here is we have, once again, the capacity of people who have historically, at every single, without exception, name me the exception, I challenge you. Name me the exception where the government came forward and said, we made a big mistake here, we're responsible, let's make it right. They always go through this protracted statement of denial. 17 years to get DDT out. That's how long it took. How many people were killed and died because their immune systems were compromised? How many wildlife and special and exotic species were injured? How much of our environment was forever polluted because of that? This is the way it works. So then when someone in the audience who's skeptical says, well, I'm sure that if a vaccine wasn't effective, our pediatricians or scientists would tell us, and I'm sure that if it were dangerous, they would also tell us, so I just can't believe this, then don't. But then how do you reconcile every single one of the thousands upon tens of thousands of historical precedents where individuals have been betrayed, lies have been given forth, secrets have been kept from the American public against their own well-being by these very same institutions? Suddenly, they're supposed to develop overnight an ethic they've never had in the past? Gee, how disingenuous. We've lied to you at every time we have had an opportunity in history, but today, we're going to tell you the truth. Vaccines are safe and effective. Problems with temporary immunity and benefits of childhood disease. Let's go to the facts now. Just the facts. Vaccines provide only temporary immunity at best, whereas when you get the natural disease, you have permanent immunity most of the time. That is one of the reasons why they have to keep giving booster doses. With DPT and OPV, you need up to 5 doses. They told us that with the measles vaccine, 1 dose was needed for life. Then we started seeing more and more measles in vaccinated children. Now they're asking for a second dose, as these vaccines only result in temporary immunity. They are going to be recommending more and more doses. Barbara Lowe Fisher, one of the vaccine challengers, goes on to stress that when these diseases were endemic in the population, people would get them, would become permanently immune, as vaccines only cause temporary immunity. You're going to see more and more problems with vaccines failure. Already, measles has mutated into a more serious form of the illness, when babies are no longer protected by their mother's antibodies because their mothers have only been vaccinated and have no permanent antibodies to give to these babies. These little babies are going to get a more severe form of measles. There are many things that are happening that they didn't anticipate because they didn't do the long-term scientific studies to begin with. Scientist and activist Dr. Vera Schreibner writes, Dr. Black and associates in 1984 summarized data on the problem of ineffectiveness of revaccination published by several authors, who demonstrated that antibody titer in re-immunized children may fall after several months to very low levels, and that children vaccinated twice may still experience clinically recognizable measles, although in a much milder form. Black and associates conclude that, quote, this state in which a child is immunologically sensitized but not immune to infection, we call inadequate immunity. This observation highlighted another looming problem, namely that generations of children with this inadequate immunity would grow into adults with no placental immunity to pass on to their children, who would then contract measles at an age when babies are normally protected by maternal antibody. This was indeed confirmed by another study by Lemon and Bett Black in 1986, which demonstrated that the hemagglutinin inhibiting and neutralizing antibody titers are lower in women young enough to have been immunized by vaccination than in older women. Perhaps the most unfortunate thing about the idea of eliminating infectious diseases by vaccination is that indeed there is no need to do so. As pointed out by a group of Swiss doctors opposing the U.S.-inspired policy of mass vaccination against measles, mumps, and rubella in Switzerland, they say, We have lost the common sense and the wisdom that used to prevail in the approach to childhood diseases. Too often, instead of reinforcing the organism's defenses, fever and symptoms are relentlessly suppressed. This is not always without consequences, unquote. Dr. Schreibner adds, many practitioners know that cancer patients have a particularly small number of infectious diseases of childhood to report in their medical history. Dr. Roan found evidence of a relationship between a lack of rash in measles and increased incidence of degenerative and autoimmune diseases. It's also well known that measles is an important developmental milestone in the life and maturing process in children. Why would anyone want to stop or delay the maturation process of children and their immune systems? Continuing along the same lines, Schreibner notes, mumps is a common childhood disease which is benign in the vast majority of cases. It is desirable that mumps be contracted in early childhood because when contracted in adulthood, the disease may cause meningitis or damage to the testes, ovaries, auditory nerves, or pancreas. However, and equally important, women are less likely to contract ovarian cancer if they've had mumps during childhood. Lastly, Dr. Schreibner states, there is no need to artificially immunize our children and ourselves. The body has proper natural mechanisms to create immunity to diseases. The diseases themselves are the priming and challenging mechanism of the maturation process leading to the competence of the immune system. It has been demonstrated time and again that infectious diseases of childhood are beneficial for children to catch. They function to even out differences in rates of development of different body systems and so perform a sort of balancing act in a fast-growing organism. They also represent important milestones in the overall development of children. The general inflammatory process is important in the dynamics of maturation of the immune response to disease. I feel embarrassed to hear and read of orthodox medicine's futile efforts to stop children from getting childhood diseases. It's a sign of ignorance and naive approach. The fanaticism fed by ignorance, irrational fear of illness, and greed are the moving forces behind the ritual of vaccination. Vaccine injection represents an enormous and unjustified insult to a young child. Let's take a look at vaccine experimentation on vulnerable populations. Informed consent law requires that anyone who is to receive treatment with an experimental drug or medical device must be fully informed about the drug or device, its risks and benefits, and the reasons for the study. It is a tenet of ethics that people being experimented on must be made aware of the fact that they are participating in research, and they must give their consent freely before becoming part of a study. The hallmark document concerning research ethics in the United States is the Belmont Report. It addresses the use of vulnerable populations and says that children, prisoners, and people whose capacity to consent is lowered by virtue of poverty or diminished mental capacity must be given extra protection. Inhabitants of third world countries are particularly at risk for being unwitting subjects. According to researcher Merrill Dorey, although most developing nations have regulations for informed consent, the laws in general are not as stringent, and so it is easier to find human subjects in developing nations. Pharmaceutical companies know that the thing to do is to go to Africa, Haiti, or South America, someplace like that, to choose subjects, do tests, and release the results. Then, she says, the researchers can get their innovations approved for use in developed countries where people have the money to spend on them. This does not mean that everyone in America is safe. Fisher expresses her concern for those people in this country who have vaccines tested on them. She says, the populations most vulnerable to vaccine experimentation are senior citizens, infants, and minority populations. I'm really disturbed about minority populations in the inner cities with regard to mass vaccination. Those who vaccinate go in there and just line the children up. They don't take medical histories. They don't find out if there have been previous reactions. They just pretend these biological vaccines, which are inherently toxic to many instances, are like aspirin. They simply don't know to what extent this mass vaccination campaign may be causing problems in these children. but they do know that there are higher incidences of learning disabilities, hyperactivity, and seizure disorders in inner cities. Fisher's concern for minority groups is supported by Curtis Cost, who states that the information gap in the Black and Latino community prompted him to write the book, Vaccines Are Dangerous, A Warning to the Black Community. Cost speaks of hospitals routinely inoculating newborns with the hepatitis B vaccine on the day they are born without parental consent. Reactions may prompt everything from an 18-hour sleeping episodes to high-pitched screaming. Parents on public assistance are extremely vulnerable. Welfare authorities tell them they must vaccinate their children to remain on welfare. They used to do the same thing for minority women to make sure that if they wanted to stay on welfare, they had to be sterilized. And tens of thousands of American black women were sterilized as a way of population control. That's a form of eugenics, which by extension is a form of selective breeding, which is a form of racism, and all supported by the medical community. More on that when you hear my next installment on my Abuses in Psychiatry series, which I'm just now completing. These individuals do not have lawyers to run to. They don't have the time to fight this disorder or the order. Therefore, they are extremely vulnerable. The legal aspect of all this is something that we need to address because it points to a very fundamental question. How much authority should our government have when it comes to telling us what we put into our bodies? Soldiers are another group of subjects used for the testing of vaccines. During the Gulf War, more than 690,000 GIs were inoculated with botulism and anthrax vaccines, in addition to be given the PB anti-nerve gas tablets that have been shown to cause troublesome after effects. Thousands of these servicemen and women now suffer from Gulf War syndrome, and the vaccines they receive are suspect. Dr. Black comments on the practice of using soldiers in vaccine experimentation. He says, one of the statements in the congressional hearing was that there were no studies of the long-term effects of vaccines. No one knows what will happen to these soldiers. This was a gross violation of human rights. Dr. Harrison Coulter explains the rationale behind vaccine experimentation on a mass scale. He says, if you give the vaccine to several million people, you pick up all sorts of reactions which you never find if you test 10,000 people. And this is generally recognized by the authorities. They say we have to do a post-introduction surveillance of the population, meaning that you get to give the population a large amount of vaccines. Then you stand back and see what happens. Well, how long do you stand back, and how long do you wait to see what happens, and how do you know that what's happening is being reported? What if someone has what they think is a 24-hour flu, so they don't go to the doctor, they just stay at home, stay in bed? But what if it was an adverse reaction to the vaccine? You'd never know that. How underreported are adverse reactions to vaccines? 98% of all negative reactions are never reported. Only 2% are. That's the way they really test vaccines for safety. They test it on a population of vaccinated individuals. Let's take a look at the easy measles medical fiasco. In the mid-1980s, researchers from the CDC and Johns Hopkins University started vaccinating babies as young as 4 months old with the experimental high-titer Ebmundson-Zagber easy measles vaccine. Targets were more than 1,500 black and Hispanic babies in Los Angeles and thousands of babies in several third world countries. The experiment was halted in 1991 after results of several studies showed that female babies receiving the high potency vaccine had a 95% increased death rate. 95%! Listen again. 95% increased death rate compared to those injected with the standard measles vaccine. Furthermore, children who developed a rash after receiving the EZ vaccine had an almost four-fold higher death rate in the 5 to 7 year, years following vaccination compared to those who did not develop a rash. The EZ vaccine was also shown to increase morbidity, to induce short and long-term immune suppression, and to interfere with normal growth. It stunted their growth, stunted their immune system. Children who had the highest antibody response to the vaccine developed the most profound immune suppression. And the alteration of the immune system was still present when children were evaluated 3 to 5 years after vaccination. As just to give you an example of the science behind this, you can look at the Journal of Pediatrics, June 1993, page 904. From the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, you can refer to volume 338, page 903. From Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, January 1999, volume page 48. Have the Journal of Infectious Disease, June of 1996, page 1320. And the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, February 1994, page 109. And the Epidemiology and Infection, April 1994, page 413. I give you this simply to show you that all my statements are backed by dozens of scientific studies and peer-reviewed journals. And yet, your pediatrician is not giving you one single study, one single scientific reference. It's all based upon presumptive protection. Worth Cooley, and by the way, I have over 3,000 scientific citations for just this report that's on my webpage. Worth Cooley, Prost, who of Arlington, Virginia, is a biomedical research consultant and medical ethicist who terms what happened with EZ measles vaccine, quote, a silent tragedy. She reminds us that human experimentation has been performed on vulnerable populations throughout history, with informed consent standards being repeatedly ignored, despite laws designed to prevent this from happening. Usually, Prost explains, the measles vaccine is not given before a child is 15 months old, since up until that time, antibodies from the mother provide natural protection against the usual childhood diseases. In about 15 months, maternal antibodies in the bloodstream decline and the child's own immunity system matures enough to respond to infectious agents that it encounters either through the environment or through vaccines. In the 1980s, the World Health Organization declared measles a life-threatening illness in third world countries. To lower infant mortality rates, they recommended that the high titer EZ measles vaccine be used on infants younger than 15 months old. Theoretically, a high enough concentration of viral particles would overwhelm the maternal antibodies, making it effective treatment for younger babies. Prost argues against this presumption, saying that vaccines given too early have no effect. Furthermore, she says, not only does it not work, there are impelling medical arguments that vaccines given too early compromise the child's capacity to respond to vaccines given later. If you give a baby a vaccine at 9 months that he's not supposed to have until he's twice that old, and then give it again at 18 months, he's going to be worse off than if you just waited until he was 18 months old in the first place. Not only did the experiment prove ineffective, it had disastrous consequences. Says Prost, in 1987, four very large studies, and I use the comment large because in third world countries, research that they sponsored often falls far short of usual standards using the very high titer EZ measles vaccine were sponsored by the CDC and the U.S. United States Agency for International Development, Johns Hopkins University, and their Department of International Health. These studies used concentrations of EZ vaccine in doses of 10 to 500 times. Let me repeat that. Let me repeat who is responsible. I want to show you exactly who caused death. Center for Disease Control killed these children. United States Agency for International Development killed these children. Johns Hopkins University killed these children. And their Department of International Health killed these children. Was anyone held accountable? No. Was anyone sued and brought up on charges of violating international human rights? No. Was anyone accused of justifiable or non-justifiable homicide? No. That means that as long as you're in a position of power, you can kill as many people as you want, as long as you're saying, well, it was in the best interest of whom? When you're giving a vaccine at 500 times the standard in babies as young as 4 months old, and where did you select these children? What if you only selected rabbis' children? Let's start with that. Okay? Then you selected U.S. senators' children. And then they select only top multimillionaires' children. That you had to have children whose parents made more than $500 million or more, or was worth that. People were policymakers, respected, opinion leaders, respected. First, would these people volunteer? If you went to them and said, look, we're going to experiment on a vaccine that may be able to help children who are at higher risk of measles in third world countries. And we're going to give it to your child at 500 times the normal dose. First, how many of them would want to be a part of your experiment and donate their children for that? Because if you killed thousands of their children, do you think it would be kept secret? Do you think you could walk away from it? If you killed all the kids of all the senators, of all the religious leaders, let's take all the Baptists, let's take all the Catholics, the elders, not those who are not married, but let's take those who are hierarchical in the Lutheran, Presbyterian, Christian churches. How long do you think that this would have stayed covered up? Why didn't anyone in this audience know what I'm reporting? Why didn't you see anything about it? Why didn't you read anything about it? Why wasn't on the network news? Why am I telling you that you're hearing about this for the first time? Does that tell you something about racism in our society? About how we value certain people and don't value others? What we say to be politically correct and what we do are almost always at odds when it comes to how much value a certain life has compared to another life. And hence, the CDC is fully aware that third world countries, Haiti, Senegal, Mexico, and Guyana, Biswa, that's where they use these dumping grounds where there's no one to fight for the poor, where the minorities have no rights whatsoever. Who's going to be there? Who's going to champion their cause? A nun? Yeah, a nun would. They're great. And then who's going to listen to the nun? We didn't even listen to the nuns in El Salvador. Not even when they were raped and killed. We wouldn't even make the people responsible, brought to justice, because it wasn't in our State Department or Defense Department's best interest. Later, it was showed that soldiers did, not the rebels didn't kill them. Rape meant it was the soldiers. We knew that all along. Just remember, every single phone communication in the world is monitored. So all those people have been talking, and who's been keeping that information? And the aerial reconnaissance photographs, satellites filming everything all the time, all over the world, every day, thousands of them. Nothing goes on that's not aware. But why don't we ever have the truth come out? So I'm talking here about deeper issues. The value of life. Who will we experiment upon and who we will not? Yeah, a Gulf War vet going in to fight what he considers an important fight. No rights. A child, a poor kid, in the World Health Organization, one of the most utterly, and I will say this on the record, one of the most utterly corrupt, immoral institutions in the history of this last century. Failed programs consistently. And they're the ones heading the pharmaceutical interest-driven AIDS program in Africa. By the way, my office has repeatedly contacted them to see if any of their officials would come on and debate me on any of these issues, and they have refused to. But they're the ones who are behind this. Now, I would have said, if you have an epidemic of measles in any of these countries, which indeed you could, that part is true, then why not go in there and find out what's causing the measles? How about malnutrition? How about septicemia and cholera and typhoid? And how about not having adequate nutrition and having taken away people's food stamps or some form of food ration and food allowances and cooking oil allowances and fuel allowances and gasoline allowances so people can't even get to where they have to go to work or can't get to get to where they can transport their goods to market because the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank went in there and said, we'll give you, never the people, of course, that never, ever, ever happens. They can never show one single instance where the actual person actually benefits from this billions of dollars in boondoggles. Last night I had a very in-depth conversation with a Russian who's over here doing some research work talking about the joke, the absolute joke in Russia about how every single penny that goes in the country for any form of aid always goes to the organized crime. Always. This person just looked at me and says, Gary, do you think for one moment that anyone in the banking community in Russia doesn't realize where every nickel goes? He said, what do you think when you've got a 22-year-old running a bank that doesn't even have a high school education? All organized crime. Every nickel the International Monetary Fund never went to help the average Russian. It went to help the people who are in positions of power. Well, the same thing here. Put in well water. Give them proper nutrition. Give them proper hygiene. Give them proper housing. Give them a way to supply themselves with what the basics. But that's not a part of our policy. That goes against the multinational concept. So we'll give them a vaccine. Pay no attention to what causes their famine, their drought, their disease. Look at the symptom and correct it at the symptom level. And then brag about what you're doing. Well, there's another side to that. The cause should be looked at. Anyhow, it was these people that I just mentioned, these organizations, that decided that they could give up to 500 times the standard in babies as young as 4 months old. Prost refers to this instance as a huge silent disaster for third world countries and inner city USA. Had the experiment not been stopped, largely and almost exclusively through the efforts of just one single person, was anyone at the CDC concerned about the lives they were killing in these countries? No, never had been. But then again, these are the smart guys from Harvard and Yale and all those other places where you couldn't get you could get away with this at the CDC, who gave you the Tuskegee experiment. And if people are willing to give you the Tuskegee experiment, that shows you what they think about blacks, then, and by the way, any of the positions that they've had that they've filled down there, ask them what their position ethically is on Tuskegee. Would they ever duplicate that under their tenure? And if that would be one way of challenging some of the ethics of people who are driven by the wrong motives. The consequences would have been far worse, but one single person looked at the data that everyone was seeing and said, this must stop. She says, it's very unlikely that any of those deaths would ever have been linked to the vaccine, since deaths were delayed. They didn't begin until 6 months after vaccination, and they continued up to 4 years after vaccination. Additionally, the deaths were not from measles. Babies died of infections, diarrhea, malnutrition, and other things that third world babies usually die of, because what the vaccine did in some babies, particularly girls, was cause a broad immunosuppression. It's important to point that out. At least in Haiti, the study was done on a population that included a number of HIV-positive infants. So there were children given this very high dose daily, very high dose of vaccine, who were already known to be immunocompromised. In the beginning, Prowse notes, results of the experiment were glowing. But once the data was analyzed, this presumption changed. The study was deemed a success, and by October 1989, the World Health Organization was recommending the high titer easy vaccine to third world children as young as 6 months. They were posting a contract of 250 million doses. By January 1990, just 3 months later, the directors of one of the two African sites notified the World Health Organization, the CDC, of a possible link between increased death in the babies who were given the higher titer vaccine versus babies who got the regular. In April that year, Dr. Gorin, director of the Senegal site, reanalyzed his data and found the same thing. He alerted the World Health Organization to the problem and was essentially ignored. In January of 1991, there was an international meeting of the vaccine team. Dr. Gorin's death data was presented in full. Going into the meeting, he had believed that once the rest of the team saw the figures, they would say, oh my God, yes, he's right, the vaccine is causing deaths, we're killing children. But he was astounded to see his data set aside. The studies were to continue. Prowse goes on to say that at that point, Gorin decided that the only ethical thing to do was publish his data independently. When you're in the medical research and you're part of a study team, publishing something independently is like being part of an orchestra and suddenly deciding to stand up and do a solo. It's very unusual. But given that the vaccine was causing increased death and that the team was not responding to the data, Gorin thought that that was his only ethical choice. Dr. Gorin's article appeared in The Lancet, one of the gold standard medical journals, on October 1991. By that time, the John Hopkins team that had been doing this research in Haiti had gone back and collected mortality data and thought that Dr. Gorin might be right. The World Health Organization called for an independent analysis of death to be presented at a meeting in June 1992. By this time, easy measles vaccines studies were already taking place in the United States. 1,500 mostly black and Hispanic 6 to month 9 olds and inner city Los Angeles babies were enrolled in a study that used the high titer vaccine. Parents were not told that the vaccine was experimental, only that their children were in a study comparing two different kinds of schedules of measles vaccine to see which one worked better. The parents did sign something, but the paper left out a key little fact about this being, number one, an experimental vaccine, number two, associated with increased death. In October 1991, the Los Angeles program was halted. In June 1992, Dr. Gorin's position was vindicated as it became clear that the easy measles vaccine was significantly associated with increased death. The vaccine was withdrawn internationally. By then, the vaccine had been used in about 24 countries, from Bangladesh to Zanzibar, in studies involving at least 15,000 children. Not all of them receiving the high titer EZ, but many certainly did. Nobody knows how many of those children died. Prowse feels strongly that had it not been for the actions of one man, not the organizations, not the CDC, not John Hopkins, no, not the World Health Organizations, absolutely never, we may have had a tragic and unnecessary loss of life of almost unparalleled proportions. And the press never, ever, ever reported the enormity of the incident. Isn't it nice to know that you can always count on members of the press to back your butt? She asked people to look back at the Tuskegee experiment, which went on for 40 years, and reminds us that it was not the Public Health Service or the CDC that exposed that to the public in 1972. A journalist, a single journalist, Gene Heller, began a series of articles after a social worker employed by the Public Health Service in California had been writing to the Public Health Service and the CDC for years with no results. He questioned the ethics of denying a diagnosis of treatment of syphilis to people in the interest of science. Finally, the material was turned over to a reporter who covered it, causing an immediate end to the experiment that went on for 40 years and it only stopped because the press, one member of the press, got the story. I'm Gary Nall. That brings us up to the end of another program on Vaccines, A Second Opinion. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346, program number 2782. Have a nice day. I'll see you on our next program.